Thank you for the introduction and thank you for the invitation. So as Sebastian said, so I'm going to discuss some aspect of non-perturbative unitarity in quantum field theory in relation from the perspective of the functional renormalization group. And this is a work in collaboration with Astrid Eichhorn and Christoph Wetterich, and so this will be out soon. The motivation for this work is, of course, quantum gravity. So originally, the main problem in the formulation of quantum field theory for the gravitational interaction was to construct a theory that was renormalizable and unitary at the same time. So the problem was basically the Einstein-Hilbert gravity gives a unitary theory that is, however, non renormalizable, at least from a perturbative point of view. On the other hand, adding higher derivative terms to the action makes the theory perturbatively renormalizable, but spoils unitarity because the r minus squared term basically introduces a massive spin to ghost, as it was shown by Stella in 1977. And of course, there are several proposals for constructing a theory, a quantum theory of gravity that satisfies both of these requirements. And one of the proposals that was suggested by Weinberg in 1976 is the asymptotically safe approach to quantum gravity. And the idea is to try to stay within the framework of quantum field theory, but instead use a generalized notion of renormalizability. This generalized notion of renormalizability is basically based on the existence of fixed points of the renormalization group flow, and was basically introduced as a consequence of the Wilsonian approach to renormalization, and in particular a paper by Wilson and Kogut that was appeared in the 70s. And Weinberg, in fact, proposed that eventually gravity could make sense as a quantum field theory, if the gravitational energy flow attains a non-trivial fixed point in the ultraviolet. So from this point of view, quantum field theories could have two equivalent well-defined UV completions that are the asymptotic freedom and asymptotic safety. Asymptotic freedom, of course, is this doesn't really work. Asymptotic freedom is well known from quantum field theories, and basically the theory in the ultraviolet becomes scale invariant, and the couplings vanish in the ultraviolet. In other words, the couplings approach the so-called Gaussian fixed point, that is the origin of the theory space, where all couplings vanishes. And this is exactly the region where the perturbative expansions of quantum field theory work well. Equivalently, in the ultraviolet, the renormalization group flow could approach an interacting theory, so still a regime where the theory is scale invariant, but the couplings approach not the Gaussian fixed point, but an interacting fixed point. So they are finite, but the theory is interacting. And the theory could be weakly interacting, so the Gaussian fixed point could stay in a nearly perturbative regime, or strongly interacting in principle and stay away from the Gaussian fixed point. How to check, how to verify the existence of this kind of fixed points. So in principle, there are several possibilities. And one of the possibilities is that of using non-perturbative methods of the functional renormalization group. This can be applied to, of course, several theories. And the case of gravity was studied, let's say, 20 years after Weinberg's proposal. And so now I'm going to show the case for the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. It is easier to visualize, and probably most of you is familiar with this phase diagram that shows the normalization group flow of gravity in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, where here the horizontal axis is the dimensionless cosmological constant, and the vertical axis is the dimensionless Newton constant. And in this case, there are two fixed points, the Gauss fixed point that is a saddle point, and the reason is that the direction associated with the Newton coupling is repulsive, because naively, because the Newton constant has a negative mass dimension, and so the flow basically is repulsed by the Gauss fixed point. But still, the theory could be UV complete thanks to the existence of a non-Gauss fixed point that is attractive in the ultraviolet. And this is the case of the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, and one should check for more extended truncations in the and in particular, consider all possible operators that are allowed by the symmetry of the theory. So far, so a number of a huge number of truncations have been checked, and it seems that there are a finite number of relevant directions that is typically three, but there are also some computations where the number of relevant directions is two. But the key point is that going beyond the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, so considering higher order operators, so there will be, of course, terms like Arrhenius square or the Gorff-Sagnotti terms and all possible higher derivative terms that are compatible with the symmetry of the theory. And at this point, given this result, given that terms like Arrhenius square introduce a massive spin to Gauss, one would naturally ask then if the theory is unitary. So now I say that non-perturbative effects are important to understand, might be important to understand the renormalizability of the theory. More generally, non-perturbative effect could be important to understand both renormalizability and unitarity. And the concept of non-perturbative unitarity emerged again in the 70s in these papers. These were among the first paper where the concept of non-perturbative unitarity emerged. And in its first formulation, the idea was that even if these kind of theories are not unitary due to the presence of a massive spin to Gauss, eventually the introduction of quantum effect can make the Gauss unstable and restore eventually unitarity. But as we'll show you in this talk, so I will also discuss this this point, but there is much more. So I'm going to start from the very basic points about unitarity. Since I'm talking about, or at least the idea, the main goal is then to discuss unitarity in asymptotic safety, we are within a quantum field theory approach. And in quantum field theory, the notion of unitarity basically reduces to the unitary condition for the S matrix. The S matrix can also be decomposed in terms of an identity part and the transfer matrix. And if I simply replace this relation into the unitarity condition for the S matrix, what I get is the famous optical theorem. The optical theorem is an operatorial relation, and is stated in these terms. So the imaginary part of the transfer matrix is given by this square of the T matrix, and it must be positive in order for unitarity to be satisfied. And at this level, it is a fully non-perturbative statement in the sense that it does not rely on any perturbative expansion. In practice, if one wants to verify unitarity, this relation has to be checked process by process, and from a perturbative point of view, also at each order in the perturbative expansion. Process by process means that for a given initial and final state, what I want is that this relation also, and that this part of the right-hand side of the optical theorem is positive. Now, this is basically a transition amplitude, and in order to write this in terms of a transition amplitude, what I can do is to rewrite this by inserting an identity. And this is a very key step. What one gets diagrammatically is something like this. And here, what happens is that there is a sum over states. What are these states? These states are all possible states belonging to the set of asymptotic states. If there are no ghosts in the theory, this is the fourth space, in other words. And this cut is given by the cutting rules, introduced by Kapotowski and well summarized as explained in this paper by Toft and Feldman called Diagrammer. And basically, a cut means that an intermediate propagator with a cut corresponds to a particle going on shell. So as I said, this is nothing but the identity operator. And in order to have a well-defined right-hand side of the optical theorem, of course, depends on what is this identity. And this depends on the set of asymptotic states, which is n. But if the set of asymptotic states contains ghosts, that means negative norm states, this identity will actually contain minus signs. And this will affect the right-hand side of the optical theorem. And this eventually leads to a loss of physical unitary. So in order to understand whether a theory is unitary or not, what one should do is to understand what are the asymptotic states belonging to this set of asymptotic states or the Fock space. And in order to understand this, it is useful to introduce the spectral representation for the propagator, because this does not rely on any perturbative expansion. It is a completely non-perturbative representation for the propagator. So here, delta is the propagator, and rho is a spectral function. Inverting, this is nothing but the imaginary part of the propagator. And for stable particles, this is a Dirac delta, because this way I just get back the Feynman propagator for a scalar theory. In general, the propagator for a theory with many degrees of freedom will have this form. This is, I think, the most general form that one can get for a propagator. So basically, one just uses the Cauchy integral formula to translate every piece of the propagator, every pole, into one of these parts of the propagator corresponding to one particular degree of freedom. And there might be, in particular, real poles that corresponds to stable particles, complex conjugate poles, and contribution from unstable particles. And these are basically the residues associated with these degrees of freedom. Now, what enters the optical theorem? What enters the optical theorem is basically the contribution from stable particles.
Sorry, are you going to tell us what is the physical interpretation of complex poles, or is that the next thing?
So this is something that could happen in principle, that there are complex conjugate poles. So when there are complex poles, so in principle one could have problems with reflection positivity, but they are not going to contribute here. And the reason is that for complex poles, complex conjugate poles, also the residues are complex conjugates. And so when I take the imaginary part, these guys cancel out, and they are not going to contribute there. So I don't know if there is any specific physical interpretation of complex poles.
So what would ghosts look like? They just have the wrong sign over there?
So here, if there are a stable ghosts, then they belong to this sum, and they come with negative residues. of course, the negative residue can be here also be in a stable particle. So this R can be either positive or negative in all of these terms.
Presumably, it doesn't matter if it appears in the middle term, right?
Here?
Yeah.
No. Anyhow, it would cancel out. So this is not really a problem. Of course, if a Gauss is here, this means that the residue is negative. So as I said, in the case of stable particles, the spectral density is a delta. So this term reduces to the sum of deltas, and this enters the optical theorem. Okay, and there are these residues. If there are ghosts, then there will be residues negative, that are negative, and this translates into negative signs in this sum. And these signals a loss of unitarity. Of course, there might be also ghosts that are unstable. And in that case, they are not really 2 degrees of freedom of the theory, so they don't belong to the set of asymptotic states, unless one is in an approximation or in a physical process where the interaction that makes that particular particle or ghost unstable can be neglected. And that case is different.
Sorry, can you, Nidigon is about, what's the bound of Nidigon?
What is that?
What is the range of integration?
So this is a threshold mass square.
Yes.
And so this is basically the threshold energy for the production of lighter particles.
Okay. So because how do you decide what goes into the sum and what goes into the integral there? Because sigma could be a delta function.
No. So this is just the part that is not a delta function. So this is the continuum part.
Yeah.
Exactly, the continuum part of the total spectral density. Now, it is important to understand what is the role of interaction and what is the role of quantum effect for this analysis. So if I start from a very simple example, so a Bayer propagator that is just one degree of freedom, so one pole, and I resum quantum effect, in general, I would get a self-energy contribution. And this self-energy contribution, if it is real, could simply create a shift in the mass of the particle. But if it has an imaginary part, then it could make the particle or the ghost unstable. Okay, so if a ghost in the Bayer propagator initially belongs to this kind of this part of the propagator, so the part representing stable particles, resumming quantum effect could make it unstable. And if it is unstable, it does not contribute to the right hand side of the optical theorem anymore, because it's not in the set of asymptotic states. And this is one possibility. There are, of course, several possibilities, but the key point is that taking...
If it's real, if it has the wrong sign, it could change the sign of the residue. Right? Is alpha q squared, for instance. Am I wrong? And alpha is...
Yeah, so this can also be this can also come with a negative sign. So a ghost can be unstable. If this was the question,
no, I'm saying the self energy
create
ghosts, even if it's real.
Yes, or vice versa. So it is possible that so when one resums quantum effect,
okay,
and
can change the sign,
everything could change in principle. So the idea is that in order to infer about the unitarity of the theory, it is crucial to take into account the quantum effect and in relation with the functional normalization group, as I will show, it is also crucial to take into account the flow through the entire theory space, so taking into account all possible operators associated with the symmetry of the theory. So how do we take quantum effect into account? So one possible way is just to use the path integral and derive the effective action from the path integral. But this is equivalent to solve, in principle, exactly the functional reorganization group equations that are given by this equation, the Wetterich equation. This is just a regulator term, and this gamma k is a scale dependent effective action. And this equation basically describes the flow of the effective action through an infinite dimensional Fourier space. And now, in the limit where k goes to infinity, what one gets is the classical action. For finite k, what I get is the result of integrating out fast fluctuating modes with frequency bigger than k, okay? And it is important to notice that this part, as I mentioned several times, contains all terms that are compatible with the symmetry and the field content of the theory. And taking the limit for k that goes to infinity, one gets the ordinary effective action. And in this case, all quantum fluctuations are integrated out, so the effective action is typically non-local and incorporates all quantum effect. That means that every quantity that I compute using the ordinary effective action is fully dressed. And this is exactly the object that I have to use to check the unitarity. But the key problem is this, I mentioned it several times, because this is really the key issue, if you want. We should consider all terms, all possible operators. But in practice, this is extremely difficult. And typically, we work within truncations. But working within a truncation means that one has a number of higher derivatives. And the number of higher derivatives means several poles in the propagator. And one could ask then, what is the physical meaning of all these poles that I'm generating? Of course, not all of them can be physical. Maybe some of them are physical, some of them are not. So what is the nature of these poles? And can these poles be removed by quantum effect when I sum over all quantum fluctuations of all scales? And can I infer a connection between the poles appearing within truncations and the poles generated by the fully quantum effective action? And do I have a way to understand whether poles appearing in truncation will also appear in the the fully dressed propagator? And these are the questions that I'm asking myself, and I would like to answer step by step. So the idea, the main goal is to understand whether to apply this to gravity. But as a first step to answer this question, I will take the case of QED as a working example. And of course, I don't know what is the fully dressed action for QED. So I'm going to take a toy model for it. And this toy model is just the one loop effective action. So the effective action is as this form, the F squared term and the non-local function. And the non-local function is the typical logarithm appearing in the one loop effective action. This is taken from this paper. So this is well studied in the latent literature, and so the propagator looks like this. And there is a pole corresponding, of course, to the photon, and one more pole that corresponds to an unstable ghost. The ghost is unstable.
Mm-hmm. Is that the effective action of QED not linear in the field? So I'm trying to understand what effective action this theory is for. Because usually people talk about this Euler-Heisenberg action, which is nonlinear in the field. So what are you integrating out here to get?
This is obtained by integrating out either a scalar field or a fermion, okay?
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, this coefficient would change depending on what you integrate out, okay? And so after integrating out one metal degrees of freedom, this is what one gets. It's basically a correction to the f squared term.
But shouldn't there be terms that are nonlinear in f as well?
Not to my knowledge. No.
By these fields, it's only alpha that get rid of the problem.
Right, I mean, in general, if you integrate out the fermions, you would get some determinant,
right,
which is nonlinear in the field, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, I mean, it is possible, yeah. Okay.
So you just have the propagator part, maybe.
Okay,
so
you just try
yes.
out everything other than.
Yes, and the. So this is just, I would say this is an approximation because, yes, so if I, so in principle, yes, there would be a more complicated corrections, but, so the point here is just to take an effective, so a toy model for the effective action, and this is everything that I need in order to study the propagator.
Okay.
And I could also take something different and analyze it as well. Like this is what I will do later to understand the connection between poles within truncation and poles in the effective action. Okay. And
But is that I mean, there's kind of an ambiguity here because imagine that P is the square of something. Okay, for instance, it's the, you know, it's a non-local pair, which is the square of something. Then you could redefine, you know, you could attach this that something to one to the left f, the other one to the right f, and then you could redefine your field variables and change your interaction term such that now you have a new. So this split between non-locality of the propagator and the interaction, you can't really study the non-locality of the propagator without understanding the non-locality of the interactions.
Yes, but if I redefine so you're saying basically that I could redefine the fields and absorb some part of the non-local action into the fields. But
put it into the interaction.
Yes, of course, but then I'm also changing other amplitudes.
That's what I'm saying. But it means that just turning the propagator is not. It's not enough in the sense because it's the propagator with the proper coupling. Anyway.
This is a good question. So in principle, studying all amplitudes, nothing would change because I mean, what I'm just removing it from the propagator,
you can add new poles there, but then the interaction vanishes.
So if the pole structure cannot change in the sense that if the field redefinition then would be singular in one point, and then I don't think I can properly do this, or at least I would
pull to the propagator and then subtract these poles
mm-hmm.
by having an interaction term that vanish at the location.
I don't think the field redefinition can be done if.
Without redefining.
So at least one has to be careful to with field redefinition that are singular in one pole.
Singular.
Yeah, but who knows that you're not doing that?
I'm not cheating.
What I'm saying is that talking about the propagator without knowing what it is attached to is.
You need both. It's fully gauging, right? Because the photon is massless.
Mm-hmm.
The standard approach is to introduce a regulator with some kind of a cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
You do all of that, and in the end, you let the regulator cutoff go to infinity, and the thing is renormalizable.
Mm-hmm.
The definition of renormalizability. Your theory is that it doesn't depend on the cutoff. It only goes to infinity. So what I just said, unitarity, everything.
Wait, so this is the effective action. So the same that you would get by solving the path integral. renormalizability is something that so typically we what we do is to check for the flow of a scale dependent version of the effective axon and see what happens in the ultraviolet, so whether the theory is finite or not.
Yeah, but the point is that QED works very well.
Yes, but so the point.
Mm-hmm. You don't need to do effective action.
No, but
yes, but this is.
She does not want to occur in QED, but she wants to consider some effect in a toy model.
Yeah.
Exactly.
She wants to understand some things so that she can apply it to something deeper. How do you deal with. There's a ghost in the effective action, how do you deal with it?
Exactly. Or there will be several ghosts in truncation at least. So in this case, there is the pole corresponding to the photon and one more pole that corresponds to the ghost, that in this case is unstable due to the fact that there is a logarithm and the logarithm has a branch cut, right? And it's also due to this minus sign. So the logarithm, in fact, can be decomposed in this way. So it has an imaginary part in corresponding to the branch cut. And it turns out that the pole, the ghost pole, lies on the branch cut. So this is what basically makes the ghost unstable. And so basically the absorbing part of the propagator can be decomposed in this way. So there will be a cut on the photon propagator and another part that corresponds to the unstable ghost. And the first part is the delta that enters the right-hand side of the optical theorem. While this guy the ghost is unstable, so it doesn't enter the right-hand side of the optical theorem. Of course, there might be different situation in the sense that this is just a one-loop effective action, maybe also not considering other terms. So I'm just taking this as a studying case. The situation might be different in general. But what I want to understand is the connection between a toy model for the poles in a toy model for the effective axon and the poles at finite truncation. And in order to do so, so let me rewrite now the effective axon in this form. So in general, we would have something that is k-dependent. And in principle, if I'm taking into account all possible terms, I have an infinite sum of couplings times box operators. And then I have to flow down to k equal to zero. And if I'm taking into account all possible operators, what I get is exactly the resummation of the logarithm, assuming that this is really the effective axon. But this only happens if all terms are included. Of course, in general, working within truncation, what we have is just a partial sum that depends on the truncation order. And this, of course, will have this function p, that is what the function that appears here, will have several zeros. And so the propagator will have several poles. So the propagator, at least the scale-up part of the propagator, will have this form. Q square is just the photon pole, and then there is this function that for a given truncation order n will have this form, okay, with a partial sum. And z is just a shortcut for dimensionless momentum. And in all plots, alpha is set to 1, but it doesn't really matter, this value. And this is the situation in terms of poles. So real poles are the blue dots, and complex poles are represented by red dots. And this is the position of the pole, Q square, as a function of the truncation order. What do we see? So beyond the complex poles, so in this talk, I will mostly focus on real poles. And as you can see, so if I increase the truncation order, at the beginning, there will be a ghost pole here. And after a few steps, this is gone. But there is also another ghost, a persistent ghost that is here, and it is even a tachyon. So if I look at this within Trungesson and I want to naively get an answer, I think, okay, the theory is sick. I cannot do anything with this.
Sorry, what is going on? I'm a bit confused here. So what
are you
talking about is N?
So N is the Trungesson order, is basically this N here. Okay, so I'm expanding the function P of Z in the powers of Z, that is
so
the...
You keep increasing N and then you keep adding poles.
Exactly, so the higher is N.
And so what are you plotting in the vertical axis here?
So this is the real part of the position of the pole for Q square.
Because I mean you have n poles.
Yes, and they are all of these poles. So for a given n, I will have all of these poles.
And these are all of them?
All of them, okay. Yes. And
shouldn't you have more of that, more than that? Like for 40, you shouldn't be 40 poles.
Yeah, so there are several complex poles. And now, so let's focus on the real poles. So as I said at the beginning, there is this this one, and at some point it is gone. And there is also a tachyonic ghost. And this is strange. Because so this actually approaches this minus one, that means it approaches the value q square equal to minus m square. This is the threshold mass that basically appears inside the logarithm. And we know that, of course, this guy is not in the full theory. We only have an unstable ghost. So we shouldn't.
You have to be concerned about analyticity.
About?
Analyticity plays an important
role. Yes, of course.
Start doing complex poles. Mm-hmm. You've got poles on either side of the Riemann sheets.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And this is not very good.
Of course, it is not very good. So that is.
This is a sick theory.
Exactly. But this is a truncated theory. So we know that in the effective theory, or at least the toy model that I'm considering, there are no complex poles. So these are just intermediate poles. And of course, in general, if it happens that I have complex poles in the full theory in Euclidean, it means that, so maybe they would not give problems for the optical theorem, but then I cannot really discretize. So of course, it would be a problem. But so right now, I want to focus on the real poles, because this is really...
physical problem, the complex pole, other than the metastable states? Physically, why would there be problem? If there are complex poles.
So basically, if there are complex poles, also depending on the position of the poles, might not be possible to pick rotate.
Yeah, that's a technical.
Yes, yes.
It's not a physical problem.
Yes.
It's an inconvenience.
Yes, it means that it's bad for us because we would not be able to use Euclidean, or one should invent something different. So for instance, there are models for in the case of Liebig theories, I have seen some ways to define them as non-analytically bicrotated theories. But yes, of course.
It shows an instability, doesn't it? Because it's
instability.
It's just instability because you have complex frequencies, right? So you have a classical solution with complex frequency. And since it comes in complex conjugate, one of them would be. Imagine
it would be growing
exponentially, the other would be decaying exponentially, or the exponential would be a problem. So I think that's why.
I'm not super
sure about that. But
it's classical instability, so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wait, but if you cannot, if they don't appear in the asymptotic states, they cannot talk of your initial.
No, I'm just saying that if this is your action, your classical equation of motion would have a classical unstable solution, if you have a complex. So quantum mechanically, I guess you don't have to excite it.
Depends on the interaction.
Yeah.
Really, no, I don't.
Depends on a lot of things. Okay, I want to try to understand what is this, because this doesn't belong to the full theory. And it turns out that the presence of this pole simply depends on the convergence properties of the logarithm. and this is what I'm going to show now. So this is the p function, okay, as a function of q squared, okay? The black line is the full function, that means this function in the limit when n goes to infinity. And so in the way towards convergence, this function, by increasing the truncation order, will keep alternating negative and positive divergences. And every time it diverges negatively, it generates a zero. And the zero here means a pole in the intermediate propagator, in the truncation. And there is one more thing to notice. So as I increase the truncation order, these zeros are going to move towards q squared equal to minus minus one in dimensionless units, but minus m threshold square, right? And this is simply due to the convergence properties of the logarithm. So of course, this is not a true degree of freedom of the theory. This is a fake degree of freedom of the theory.
So for n equal 100,
going 101, it is very close to minus one still.
100, then it would go up.
Sorry?
For n equal to 100, it would go up.
Yes.
And the place would be exactly at the same place, or?
Yes, so it will be positive divergent, okay? So in this case, so for n even, would not generate a zero. And then 101, it gets again a negative divergence and it generates a zero, so a pole here. And
in the limit, this divergence is disappearing.
Yes, of course. So in the limit n that goes to infinity, this function exactly converges to this point. It doesn't have any divergence anymore because there is an exact balance between terms that are negatively diverging and the terms that are positively diverging. And this happens only in the limit n that goes to infinity. And this means that within truncation, I will always see this kind of poles. I want to understand this better. So, and this is related to the convergence properties of the logarithm. So the logarithm has, of course, a finite radius of convergence, and this is this ball, basically. And beyond this ball, there is the branch cut of the logarithm. Now, I show you again this picture, this figure. I told you at the beginning there was this ghost, and then at some point it is gone. This is exactly the unstable ghost that appears in the full theory. An instability cannot be seen by using a perturbative expansion, basically. So this guy is what I see at the beginning here. And as I increase the truncation order, this pole basically jumps into the branch cut region of the logarithm, where the logarithm or the expansion, the Taylor expansion of the logarithm does not converge. That's why I'm not seeing this anymore. And this is the unstable ghost living in the branch cut of the logarithm. And there is also this guy that I call a fake ghost because it's not really a genuine degree of freedom of the theory, okay? And what this guy is doing is to approach the boundary of the domain of convergence of the logarithm, okay? And it is simply generated by the convergence properties. So it is not a genuine degree of freedom of the theory. Okay, and so what we learn from this is that we cannot really immediately trust what we see from truncations of the propagator.
So can you be more precise? What range of Q can you trust your propagator, and when there must be a scale at which after that you cannot trust?
Yes, this is exactly this scale, because beyond this...
The previous...
Yes, sorry.
The previous slide.
Okay.
So there was, the scale, does that scale shift or not? Or it's always the same scale?
So if I rescale the So if I use a different scale, so if it is smaller, well, here I'm just using a dimensionless momentum, so it should really, nothing should change.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because in renormalization, you do renormalization, you have a scale. So it means, so I'm getting from what you're saying that you should not trust non-perturbative or truncated renormalization.
You should not trust.
A certain scale, and that scale should be.
You should not.
You can't really go down to the UV with it.
So what I'm saying is that you should not trust the pole structure of the propagator coming from finite truncations.
Yeah, but can you trust? The next question is then, because you're using the propagator to renormalize, can you then trust non-perturbative RG? You know, in the regime where you don't trust the propagator anyway.
But so the non-perturbative FRG, so it is really needed to get in principle the effective axon and also to study the. The problem is what I'm trying to study now is the unitarity of the theory that is related to the number of poles. If you want, it is the in a few words it is the number of poles in the propagator, but this is not really a key requirement for studying the fixed point structure of the FRG equations.
You could do that. You could say, well, now that you established that you know you cannot trust your theory below a certain scale, then when you apply non-perturbative RG. There's a regime at which you cannot trust it anymore for the same reason.
That's not true.
No.
It's only true if you rely on a Taylor series in the momenta. If you go beyond that and we can do that, then you can have the full log, for example. That's no problem. It's just your basis, the basis of a Taylor expansion is not the right basis to represent the propagator everywhere because it has a finite radius. Around zero, because I have a branch cut.
Any polynomial truncation of your own interaction
No. I'm saying if you have a function of the Laplacian.
If you take a function of the Laplacian, but.
Yes, for instance, but.
You know, but
there are several ways.
But there's many truncation where people, just. Start
yes.
But you can do it.
Yes. And also, here.
That's the question.
Yes.
You just. You took the propagator, and it doesn't come from any functional renormalization or whatever.
Yes.
You just took the Taylor expansion
yes.
propagator.
Mm-hmm.
How does it relate to a truncation which you would choose in functional renormalization?
So so now what I'm going to do is just to study this pole structure at k equal to zero if you want. So if I have to redo this for an FRG computation. I haven't much time. So I should basically start from an ansatz for the axon containing n derivatives, okay? Flow down to k equal to zero, get the result, and then increase and flow down and get the result again. That if of course, challenging, especially in the case of gravity. But I will also discuss about this
okay,
later.
I suggest you try to finish the talk.
Yes, I will. Yes, I think I can also skip.
12 minutes.
Huh?
Still have 12 minutes.
Oh, okay, 12 minutes. Okay, I can.
Okay.
That's true. Okay.
One point. If you start doing these kind of expansions, you're making strong assumptions about ellipticity, circles of convergence. This is not convergent necessarily, so you can't do this expression. You have to worry about the circle of convergence.
Yes, of course.
Ellipticity.
Mm-hmm.
This is you're making a strong assumption doing this Taylor series expression.
Yes, but I mean, I can in general, like I can. well, this expansion converges within the domain of convergence. So in this case, I'm starting from something that is a logarithm. So of course, it has a finite radius of convergence, but I could do the same for an entire function, okay? And it's not really, so for to reach the, to answer the questions that I showed at some point, I don't need to distinguish between functions that have a finite radius of convergence from an entire function, because now I'm getting to an important point that regards the, like the nature of these poles, and I will show you that exactly the same holds for entire functions. Okay, so I think I have already discussed this slide. So I was at the point to say, okay, we have this result. There will be in general poles within truncations of the axon. And the question is, since so now I'm playing the game, the reverse game, if you want. I start from the effective axon, and I'm analyzing a truncation. But in general, I don't have access to the effective axon, and I work within truncation. So how do I understand what are the properties of these extra poles that I see in the axon? So, and how do I understand if the poles that appear within truncation are fake ghosts, or they are really true ghosts of the theory? And turns out that the answer to this question lies in the residue of the of the propagator evaluated at the pole. And the key point is that the residue of this fake degree of freedom as a function of the truncation order goes to zero, and it does this very fast. Or very fast, it means respect to n infinity. It means like within 100 iterations, okay? That is still a lot from the point of view of computation, but it is, if you want, it is small with respect to infinity. So if I look, so if I don't analyze the residue, this pole will be here always for any truncation, unless I take all terms, all possible terms in the axon. So unless I take the limit that for n that goes to infinity. While for the residue, within a finite number of iterations, what I see is that the residue goes to zero. And the fact that the residue goes to zero tells me that this guy is not going to contribute in the propagator. This does not enter the set of asymptotic states. And this picture really represents the fact that initially one would see something that looks like a ghost, even a tachyonic ghost, but this is not going to enter our amplitudes because the residue goes to zero. And this indicates basically that this pole is a fake degree of freedom of the theory. And now you can say, yes, maybe this is just one specific example and doesn't work in other cases. So I wanted to study more cases, even if I don't have really a even if they don't come from computations. So for instance, what I can do is to take exactly the same example as before, but flip this sign. Because if I flip this sign, what I'm doing is to put a stable ghost in the theory. And this is again the situation. So this is the pole structure as a function of the truncation order. And I have again a tachyonic ghost and a stable ghost that comes from the fact that I flipped the sign. As you can see, this belongs to the domain of convergence of the logarithm. This is below one. This is exactly related to the fact that this ghost is of the full theory is stable. And analyzing the residue, one can explicitly see what is really a ghost and what is a fake ghost. for the fake cost, the residue is initially negative, but it goes to zero almost, within 100 iterations. For the true ghost in the theory, it is the residue is negative at the beginning, but it stays negative. So the stable ghost will have a persistent negative residue, and the fake ghost, for the fake ghost, the residue approaches zero. And one can again play the same game also for entire functions and also other functions for with finite radius of convergence. And I can show you quickly the result. So for the case of entire functions, so theories that are completely ghost-free, so I can see them as theories with an infinite radius of convergence. And then the ghost, the apparent ghost that I see within truncation will move to infinity. In this case, I have a momentum to the four, so there will be two that are really symmetric, and both of them move to infinity. In the case of a function like this, so a square root, in this case, again, there is a finite radius of convergence, and the pole approaches.
Where are your axis again, sorry?
So again, this is the real part of Q squared, the position of the pole, as a function of the truncation. And so maybe you cannot really see the numbers. But so this is zero, and this goes to negative values. So this is minus 40. And the residue basically goes away from zero. It goes to infinity in this case because I have an exponential. So the radius of convergence is infinity. For a square root, again, I have a finite radius of convergence, so it the pole approaches the boundary of the domain of convergence. But for all these cases, the residue goes to zero within 100 iterations. I have to say I'm still trying to find a formal proof for this residue conjecture. Still didn't manage, but I also didn't find any counterexample so far. And I studied really several, a lot of functions. Okay, so at this point I can go to my conclusions. So the idea was to discuss unitarity from non-perturbative unitarity from the point of view of the functional error normalization group. So as I said at the beginning, it is important to include all quantum fluctuations, but this is also not enough in the sense that within truncation one would always see fictitious poles, and therefore it is important to take into account the flow through the entire Fourier space, so to take into account really all possible operators allowed by the symmetry of the theory. Within truncation, there will be fake poles. So it seems that when there is a fake pole, then the residue of the propagator evaluated at this pole will approach zero pretty fast. And therefore, somehow this could constitute a criterion within truncation to understand the nature of poles within truncation. In practice, this depends on how fast the residue goes to zero. I mean, if we are lucky, if you want, and the residue goes to zero quickly enough, then this might be feasible. But if, like in the case I have shown, I have to reach 100 iterations, this might be at least, very difficult, very challenging. So the key point that I want to make is that if we want to check unitarity and say something about unitarity in asymptotic safety, what we need is the fully quantum effective action. And if we don't manage to do this within, for instance, using these derivative expansions of the effective action and using the residue Ethereum, what one should do instead is to study really the flow of form factors, as already Benjamin and Frank proposed. This kind of computation could in principle be done, and some part of this study has been already initiated by Benjamin and Frank Sawaresib. Okay, so I think that's it for my conclusion, and I thank you for your attention.
Nice talk. We still have time for questions. Yeah.
So I have a, I guess, question and a comment. I guess, well, maybe it's just two comments.
Mm-hmm.
So this residual conjecture, I'm not sure why you think it's it actually needs a proof, because I mean, if you said the actual function doesn't have a pole, then and then your truncation is supposed to approximate the real function, so the limit of n
mm-hmm.
to infinity, then the fake pole should go away, so that means that its residue should go to zero. Right? So that's
yes, but so the point is the pole is there for all n, unless I take the limit n that goes to infinity. But the residue, instead, even if the pole is there, approaches zero much before that the pole is gone.
Couldn't an alternative be that the pole goes off to infinity? I mean, that wanders out.
But I mean, I guess I think there are two possibilities. It seems that, but okay. So it seems that either the pole should go to infinity, or the residue should go to zero.
Once you know that the residue stays in the finite complex plane, then
if you know that it's not going to infinity, then it's residue. If you know that the position doesn't go to infinity, then it's residue should go to, because we basically here you know that the real function doesn't have a pole, and you're approximating.
Mm-hmm.
At least within the radius of convergence, that should be true. I mean, outside the radius of convergence, you don't know. So then, and the other comment regarding what Laurent was saying, that you don't trust this beyond the radius of convergence, why can you do RNG? So, I mean, the example, like in QED, perturbation theory breaks down after if energy changes by factor of 2, because that's the radius of convergence of logs. So if you take log of Q around the energy scale and then expand it, we know it has a finite radius of convergence, but nevertheless, you could use RG and push this to very below, very beyond that radius of convergence.
Also, there are several ways to do this FRG computation, in the sense that, so now what I really needed to study this pole structure was basically a derivative expansion, but one could also use different expansions of the effective action and then avoid this problem. This was just something that I did to analyze the pole structure. That was, of course, easier using a derivative expansion.
Yeah, your question pointed out, if we choose a distribution which is not a delta function, an entire function, the entire function has no poles in the finite complex B squared plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't get any ghost poles.
She said,
what's wrong with that? Why not choose that truncation?
She showed what happened.
So in the case of the exponential is an entire function, still within truncation I see poles, and this is obvious, because I mean, if I truncate the Taylor expansion of these functions, then p will have several zeros. Okay, and as I increase the truncation order, since the radius of convergence is infinity, then this pole will move away to infinity, and the residue will go to zero. There are no ghosts also. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. So, but within truncation, I would see ghosts. That means that even if my FRG computation is going to converge to an exponential, within truncation, I will still see poles.
Bianca?
There were some early suggestions I believe from Dario Benedetti that the solution to the unitarity problem is actually that the pole wanders off into infinity.
Okay.
So are you saying that no, it's not the case? It's actually that the residue goes to zero?
I don't know exactly what is this paper by Dario, but I would say that there are two possibilities. So the pole, in the case of entire function, the pole go to infinity. In the case of function with a finite domain of convergence, the pole go converge to the boundary of the domain of convergence of the pole. But in any case, if the pole does not correspond to a genuine degree of freedom of the theory, the residue goes to zero.
Wrong.
I don't know if
I'm asking the obvious question about gravity. So the stated pole, which is there, seems to drive the entire RG. Is it a fake pole or?
What?
The stated pole. The R squared.
I don't know.
It becomes unreasonable with R squared. So you have a new. So this one, I mean, it's too early, but.
This is too early, but this is exactly what we would like to understand. So as soon as I add higher derivatives, for instance, R mu square,
mm-hmm.
I generate poles that are dangerous for unitarity. The question is, if I...
And you also add something to the thing that makes the theory, you know, renormalizable. So that's a big difference from adding operators that are, you know, not changing the RG behavior. So in that case, you might ask, that, you know, there's a correlation between the two phenomena.
The fact that I get a perturbative
normalization. If you don't add that term, the mm-hmm. theory is not renormalizable. You add that term, the theory becomes renormalizable and it has a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
So now the renormalizability of the theory is tied up with the presence of that ghost. That's a little bit different from having a renormalizable theory to which you add. That's what I'm saying. You know, in that case, you have to be much more careful about.
So I guess there is the conjecture, I think, at Bob Oldham and others subscribe to that you do have a ghost, but then that shouldn't just appear in your asymptotic states. And so you're not adding extra interactions, you just stick with the stellar gravity, but that ghost doesn't appear in asymptotic states.
But so how?
Yeah, that's what she's looking
at. I think what you're just looking at free theories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the statement that the ghost is strongly confined, basically. The idea is that ghost is confined.
Oh.
So if you look at
there might be several ways to make the ghost confined, but this is something different. So my point here, if I keep adding terms and I study the flow
yeah.
till k that goes to infinity, it is possible, so there are several possibilities, of course, it is possible that that ghost is a true ghost of the theory, and I will still have it in the effective axon, so in the propagator coming from the effective axon. It is possible that it gets unstable, or it is possible that it is a fictitious ghost, fictitious pole.
So for gravity, where do we stand? For the stale ghost?
Well, this is something that I still don't know, unfortunately. This was the first step. To understand what could happen in principle. And then there are several steps that one can do for the case of gravity. Several things that one could try, because some could, I would know what to do in principle, but in practice might be technically difficult. So there are several procedures that one could follow.
And what about this question about, is there a decoupling? I mean, is there a coupling between the presence of the ghost that you have in the truncation theory and, you know, the behavior of the RG flow? Can you, like, you know, even if you don't have this proof that it's a true ghost or fake ghost,
mm-hmm.
kind of a question, what is...
What? I think I didn't get properly the question, sorry.
There's two effects to the truncation. You focus on the presence of the groups, but another thing that happens is that it makes non-randomizable theory randomizable, right? So, okay, and then, you know,
but then
you could ask, is that a fixed point spurious? The same thing, is it a true fixed point or is it a spurious fixed point?
Well, but this is something that has been checked for really a large number of truncations with and without matter. And
I'm not asking about the numerical evidence, I'm asking about some, you know, like.
Mm-hmm. But the point is so, at least from the point of view of asymptotic safety or non perturbative renormalizability, even.
The point is there, yes, it's true. But if that point is there because there is a ghost, then I would say it's a spurious point.
But
you see, that's what you want to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but so for instance, in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, still one finds the fixed point, right? And
you need at least to have the R squared term, right?
R squared term for perturbative renormalizability.
Yeah. The phase space is three-dimensional, the attractive phase space. It's not two-dimensional.
It's infinite dimensional, in principle.
But sort of the approach is very different, right? Because you would first study renormalization of the theory,
mm-hmm.
and then derive the effective theory, and then study, for example,
yes.
the propagator and the pole. So it would be rather to see whether the renormalizable theory then still has a stable pole. So it's like,
mm-hmm.
but from the other direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, first we need the effective action.
No, but it's not. It's a number of relevant degrees of freedom, which is three. But it's three
yes.
in any. It's three in any higher truncation, and also which.
So it's yeah, good. It's three. So the third one is the ghost term. That's what
yeah,
I'm saying.
But so the question, I think, the logical possibility is if you go to infinite. What is the logical possibility if you go to infinite relevant?
It becomes two. I don't know.
That the ghost
become fake.
That would be bad from their point of view.
No, because the fact that it's three is a problem. I'm saying it's problematic because it's.
I'm not sure
if
people agree because
okay. Three is really low.
It's
less than infinity.
And two would be better.
Two is better, but three is fine.
I think it's only the problem if the relevant direction would confirm.
I think maybe it's a discussion about two or three.
Maybe it's a small okay. So,
three means
that there's a ghost.
Unless there's a very good question,
Alessia
again.
Three means.